You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
Until basic questions are answered about how communities coexist, the embers of extremism will continue to burn, and the world is too small for us to simply be able to build a wall and prevent it from affecting our own societies.
Barack Obama bids farewell to the United Nations with a speech on the state of the world, but will the world miss him? We'll have that debate with my guests Mary Tijewski and James Rogers here in the studio. Plus, we'll look at who attacked an aid convoy in Syria and what that means for the ceasefire. Will recent security scares stir up the US presidential race? And why has Brexit not affected the UK economy so far? Those stories and more coming up on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Tijewski, a columnist for The Independent, The Guardian, and various others, and James Rogers, senior lecturer in journalism at City University. Mary and James, welcome to you both. Let's start in Syria, which has this week seen an attack on a United Nations aid convoy in the north of the country, and earlier today an attack on a warehouse operated by the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. Washington thinks Russian planes bombed the convoy, and Moscow, meanwhile, has rejected that accusation. So what's going on, and is the ceasefire officially over? Mary Tijewski, Washington has made clear where it believes the blame lies. Boris Johnson, the UK Foreign Secretary, has actually said that publicly, sort of insinuated it publicly, rather. And Russian officials have had various different responses over the last 48 hours, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, the original and the consistent Russian response has been that they are not responsible. What has sort of shifted as time has gone on is who might have been responsible and how it might have happened. So we've had video which suggests that... weapons were being transported along, sort of using the aid convoy as a sort of cover, and that the presence of Russian planes can be overhead can partly be explained by that. But we haven't been told, for instance, what happened and if the Russian planes struck, which is what the Americans and the British are charging, or if they tried to strike the what they thought were munitions and they missed, or if, as their original and still sort of continuing story is, that they didn't strike at anything and it must have been somebody else. And as I heard a Russian journalist saying on the radio just in the last hour or so, saying that it was all very strange because there wasn't the sort of traces you would expect from an airstrike when you looked at the photographs of the wreckage afterwards, and that therefore you could be talking about an attack on the ground. So I think there's still an enormous amount of uncertainty about it.
James, do you buy all that?
Well, it's difficult to know what to buy, really, isn't it? I suspect there will never be a version of events here which all sides, all parts of the conflict will accept. I suspect that this is going to be one of those things which defies solution, and it may be that Russia and Syria will side with one interpretation of events and Britain and America and others will side with another. And it may be just one of those cases which is very difficult to determine exactly what did happen. I mean, I think what we can say, though, is that it has posed a serious threat to the ceasefire. And even for those of us who thought that this was not likely to be the end of the beginning of a lasting peace in Syria, nevertheless, however this conflict is going to end, and it's difficult to see when that will be, presumably the beginning of the end will look something like this ceasefire. And so it's a very bitter blow in that sense, that this looks like it's not going to go forward as one might have hoped.
We can talk about the ceasefire in a moment, but first of all, Mary, the Russians have said, well, look, we're happy to have an independent investigation. The problem with, frankly, believing them on this, that they're happy to have an independent investigation, is that there have been independent investigations of Russian-backed groups before who have for example, alleged to have shot down the Malaysian Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine. And there was an independent investigation, and it showed quite clearly what many people had believed at the time had happened, that it was fired by rebels in eastern Ukraine. And Russia said, "Ah, oh, no, that's not true. Here's other evidence."
Well, I think, I mean, if we get diverted for a moment into Ukraine, I think that Russians have one strong point on that, because there is reconnaissance satellite evidence that the Americans have refused to release. And so long as they refuse to release it, the Russians will say, this shows something that the Americans don't want us to see. And so the whole thing is open. If we go back to Syria, yes, I mean, there are very similarities to me as well as to you about how the Russians seem to be dealing with the strikes on the convoy. But I also think that some of the very aggressive talk from the Americans and the British chiming in can also be explained by the fact that the original breach of the ceasefire, the really, really serious breach of the ceasefire, which destroyed it practically within 24 hours of its coming into force and looking as though it might have a chance, was what the Americans eventually called a mistaken strike on Syrian army troops, and this killed 62 people, and it took about 24 hours for the Americans to say, A, yes, we did it, and B, it was a mistake. And I think there is, you know, at least some of what's going on now with the convoy, even though that was obviously an atrocity in its own right, has to be seen in the context of what happened earlier. And this is another reason why the two sides are not going to agree. You know, the Americans and the British have one set of truth, and the Russians and their supporters have another set of truth. And these things simply don't coincide.
And I get, so go on, James.
Yes, and I was just going to say, I mean, alongside those very differing versions of events which are accepted by the different outside parties, I mean, one gets the impression that there are also splits within the United States and within Russia too, between, for example, the military and the foreign ministries of those respective countries. The New York Times last week published a very strong report suggesting that the Pentagon had deep misgivings about the outline of the ceasefire for the cooperation which envisaged between the United States and Russia. And so I think that complicates matters further. Not only is there no accepted single version of events, but there are actually quite substantial different policy approaches within two of the most important outside powers, being the United States and Russia.
I also thought that it was very interesting hearing John Kerry today at the United Nations, and you might have expected him to take really quite a hardline view, instead of which the bottom line of what he said was that let's have a ban on all flights flying everywhere all over Syria. And it seemed to me that, you know, that's something, first of all, I hadn't expected him to take that line. And second of all, it did seem to be something that he referred to his Russian opposite number, Sergei Lavrov, as he was saying that. And it seemed that there might be agreement on that as a last ever attempt to save this ceasefire.
That's the thing, James, isn't it? We can look at, you know, this one attack on the aid convoy on its own if we really want. But this is within a context of a war which has cost, depending how you count, between 200,000 and 400,000 lives. And emotionally, it's quite hard to move beyond the latest incident and war crime, as the UN humanitarian chief referred to it a couple of days ago. But they have to, don't they? They have to move beyond that, because we're talking about a war that's lasted 5 years and cost hundreds of thousands of lives.
Well, that's right. And unfortunately, at this stage, it looks like there's every prospect that it could last as much as another 5 years or even longer, Steve. I mean, the thing is here, I mean, one, as an outside observer of this conflict, it seems to me that one common ingredient that conflicts need to have as they move towards a successful peace process, and however painful that may be for the various warring parties, there needs to be a will, or there needs to be, which is often brought on purely by fatigue. And I don't see that in this conflict yet. I see will on both sides to continue.
Mary, just one final thing on the Russian side of things. What do you think their short to medium term aim is in Syria now? What do you think they would like the solution to be?
I think that they would like the solution to be, and I mean, I know this is probably not a view shared by very many people. I think what they want in the short to medium term is they want a resumption of the diplomatic process, that they thought their military involvement a year ago had actually forced to happen. And it stalled and it stalled and it hasn't happened. I think the Russians would, that they want to get everybody around the table. They are not ready to go with Assad to the very end. They think that he must be part of the solution, but not necessarily to remain in power. They want diplomacy. They don't want, you know, what is said, they want, you know, they've got territorial ambitions of their own. No, I think they want to be seen as certainly as having influence and continued presence in the region, but that's not the prime purpose. I think the prime purpose is diplomacy and to stop the Syrian state falling apart.
So you actually think it's more about Russia wanting to be a major player than any sort of strategic interest that they have in, you know, a warm water port, for example?
Yes, I mean, I think they're actually on the record as saying that if Syria descended into chaos, they would get out. In other words, that they're not going to stake everything on keeping a territory, their own territorial presence in the region.
I mean, I think looking to the longer term, one has only to remember, and this is something I think which is probably reflected upon in the higher echelons of Russian diplomatic and military circles. The generation who are in charge now, most of them, many of them have served in Afghanistan. And this is something which continues to haunt Russian foreign policy to this day. And they do not want to see anything of that sort of in-depth involvement, which is why Mary referred to Russia first and getting militarily involved there about 12 months ago. They set themselves quite limited objectives, achieved them and sort of declared and they were off, because I think Russia
did declare they were off. I mean, they pretty much put up a mission accomplished banner back home, but they haven't gone home, have they, Mary?
Well, I think that the detachments that they sent in extra have been withdrawn, and that's what they were referring to when they said the operation is over and we're withdrawing. But of course Russia had, as it were, a permanent presence there around its bases and its air base and its naval base, and those people were there before the arrival of the actual extra intervention, and they remain there.
Okay, let's move on now to New York, where President Barack Obama has spoken at the annual gathering of world leaders at the UN General Assembly this week. It was his farewell address to the global body, and here's a little bit of what he said.
Until basic questions are answered about how communities coexist, the embers of extremism will continue to burn, countless human beings will suffer, but extremism will continue to be exported overseas. And the world is too small for us to simply be able to build a wall and prevent it from affecting our own societies. And we can only realize the promise of this institution's founding to replace the ravages of war with cooperation if powerful nations, like my own, accept constraints. Each of us, as leaders, each nation, can choose to reject those who appeal to our worst impulses and embrace those who appeal to our best. For we have shown that we can choose a better history.
That was Barack Obama there. James Rogers, the US president is always one of the draws at the UN General Assembly. He's one of the few world leaders who, if you work in a newsroom like we do, and you look up at your bank of TVs, he'll be there on Sky, on Al Jazeera, on France 24 speaking. And over 8 years, he's certainly put forward a different version of America than his predecessor, George W. Bush.
Yes, he has. And I think he's also... But it's going to be quite difficult to determine exactly what his foreign policy legacy is. I mean, let's not forget the huge optimism with which Mr. Obama's time in office began, that awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize so very early on.
And in his defence, that... wasn't something he necessarily wanted or sought out.
No, no, I mention that merely as a reflection of the optimism which accompanied his coming to office, and the speech in Cairo as well about reaching out to the Muslim world. Perhaps historians will come to judge that Mr. Obama faced greater foreign policy challenges than any US president in recent history, and so in some extent fell short. It's hard to say, of course, that he leaves the world a better place than he found it when he first came to office. His critics would also perhaps argue that one of his main legacies will be the United States' increasing use of unmanned aircraft or drones to strike at their enemies. Nevertheless, you're talking about the effect he has on newsrooms. I mean, I've always admired Mr. Obama for his excellent command of the language. I think he's a wonderful speaker. And I just wish, as I'm quite sure he does, that he'd been able to have the chance to provide more concrete results in foreign policy during his time in office.
Mary, the language is interesting, and it's certainly, you know, when you hear him there talking about powerful nations like our own have to accept restraints. I mean, this is the sort of thing that is catnip to loudmouth Republicans who will, I'm sure, spin that as him apologising for America. But this is a very different use of American power, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the questions is, will we miss Obama when he's gone? And of course, a lot of people will say, actually, well, we won't miss him because he didn't have that sort of highly sort of very aggressive, upfront, very, you know, it's something we really associate with America, that sort of global presence. But I think we will miss him, and I think we'll miss him increasingly, because it was very interesting to me that you picked out that particular clip of what he said, because that struck me too, that it's almost the essence of Obama of, as it were, a judicious and prudential use of American power, which means also knowing when not to use it. And I think he's been very underestimated and completely unjustly maligned, including for supposedly not honouring his red line promise in Syria. I think that his judgment on when to act and when not to act will be seen in future as maybe setting a pattern for other American leaders. And when he talks about, you know, constraints on American power that you know, even the most powerful have to accept, the last president who talked about that was actually Bill Clinton. And he had a phrase where he said that, you know, America has to sort of learn to live within laws that it has helped to set, and that it has to envisage a time when it'll no longer be top dog anymore. And I think Obama has taken that a little bit further.
James Rogers, the problem with taking that attitude is that you need others to come along with you. And, you know, we didn't hear, you know, similar words from Francois Hollande. If Vladimir Putin was to turn up at the UN General Assembly, how long is it since he's turned up there? Been a while, hasn't
Ooh,
it?
I think actually he turned up last year, okay. And that was, but it was quite a turn up for the books because he hadn't been for a long time.
It would be a bit of a surprise if he was to say something similar. Xi Jinping certainly wouldn't turn up there and say, "Don't worry, guys, we're going to be modest and in the background." I mean, perhaps Angela Merkel would have the same sort of view of, you know, power is about choosing when not to use it as well as when to use it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, America spent most of the last century involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union in a sort of balance of global power. But now for the last quarter century has really, you know, been the leading world power to which everyone has looked. I mean, it's not that long ago that the French Foreign Minister, Hubert Védrine, if my memory serves me correctly, coins the phrase hyperpuissance, hyperpower, to describe the United States in the post-Cold War world. So it's a role that really nobody's probably played before since possibly the height of the Roman Empire or maybe the British Empire at some point. But it was not one for which America was necessarily well prepared or expecting, and it faced tremendous challenges when it did it. And of course, you can point to some of the military operations like Afghanistan and Iraq in which the United States did get involved and argue with hindsight, and some did, including Mr. Obama, with foresight, that they were ill-advised. And I think this is the world with which we're now dealing.
And of course, there's also this issue, Mary, that it is one thing to be diplomatic and to follow this path when you are dealing with other nations, but it is a far harder task when you are dealing with groups like ISIS and before that Al-Qaeda, as we see around the world, whether it's Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab or others, where these are groups that don't have the same sort of political aims as terrorist groups in the past, and also aren't nation states.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the crucial thing not being nation states. And I think, in a way, everybody is still only adjusting to that, that there are these, I mean, with Islamic states, or what seem like enormous groups whose strength is actually very difficult to judge. You know, some of us would say it's actually been, its actual influence and power and territory has been exaggerated. And we've sort of mirror imaged something which doesn't actually exist. But that's half the problem with this, because it is so totally outside the rules, outside, it's not any way regulated. Nobody really has found a solution how to deal with it.
Okay, we'll take a short pause there. Mary Jacewski and James Rogers will be here when we return. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late-night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, James Rogers and Mary Dajewski. Now, if you are, certainly if you're in the UK and you turn on the news tonight, you will see all sorts of stories about how Brexit is okay for Britain. The Office for National Statistics has said Brexit has had little impact on the economy so far. And there's also been a report from the OECD today revising somewhat their forecast that has led many Brexiteers to claim everything is all right. But James Rogers, my argument would be everything might be okay because Brexit hasn't actually happened yet. Britain is still in the European Union.
And will be, one imagines, for at least a couple more years. And so it's very difficult to say. I mean, I think the Brexiteers are rejoicing because there were certain predictions that the economy was going to face very severe short-term problems, in the wake of the result of the referendum, were it to be a decision to leave, as indeed it was. And in the first couple of days, with the way that the currency suffered, the way the pound fell against other international currencies, it looked initially as if some of that might be borne out. But I would have to agree with you, Steve. We don't know what this is. We keep hearing Brexit means Brexit, but nobody knows what the shape of Britain's future relationship with Europe and indeed with the rest of the world is going to be. And so uncertainty, yes, but people, there has been no major substantial changes in the legal and political relationship yet, and so unless and until that happens, it's very difficult to judge what the effects of Brexit will be. From my own personal point of view, somebody who works in a university, there's a lot of planning there. How many students are going to still want to come to study in the United Kingdom? How's that going to work? And countless other sectors of the economy are still having similar conversations.
That uncertainty is certainly still there, Mary Dajewski. And I guess there's also this other issue that, you know, pre-referendum, first of all, David Cameron, then Prime Minister, said, well, if we vote leave, then very next morning I'll trigger Article 50 and we've got 2 years to do it. And that didn't happen. And then the other thing is, as James says, Theresa May, the new Prime Minister, keeps on saying Brexit means Brexit, but no one knows what Brexit means. So it would be one thing if we knew that that meant, well, we're leaving the single market, and then the markets might react in different ways and the economy would react in different ways. But we don't know if we're going to be in the single market or not.
No, I mean, the big, big question that's been out there really since the beginning is whether the UK can do some deal which entailed keeping membership of the single market to a degree, while at the same time being able to block the free movement of people. And what sort of a ratio you get between those two things, if any, is the big question. But, you know, I have this very, really really subjective feeling. When I pick up the papers or I listen to the news, and the headlines are that, you know, this hasn't happened, or the economic signs are really good, everything stayed the same, it's all one. I mean, I get a feeling of sort of whistling in the dark, of sort of saying, yes, it's almost a sort of propagandistic tone, that it'll be really all right. And I don't like that at all. I mean, the fact is that within seconds of the referendum result being known, the pound dropped 10% against the euro and the dollar. It's regained a little against the dollar, I think nothing against the euro. That devaluation, sudden devaluation, has not played its way through into the consumer economy yet. We will have hugely higher prices on most imports very soon. And the devaluation of the currency has given a sort of a type of temporary rescue, in the sense that it allowed the stock market to stay reasonably high, and it helped the balance of payments because it helped trade. But those things are not going to last. And I just find these super optimistic reports incredibly short-termist and really distorted and seducing people into thinking something that actually won't be.
Mm. Well, there we are. We're going to move on to some rare good news. The billionaire George Soros has just announced that he'll be investing $500 million in programs and startups and companies helping migrants and refugees. His Open Society organisation will be in charge of the funds. And James Rogers, what's interesting about this is that actually it is not just in organisations that help refugees. He actually wants to invest it in organisations started by refugees.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think here there are two facts about Mr Soros to take into account. Firstly, his considerable wealth, which puts him in a position to do this. But secondly, also the fact that in his 80s, Mr Soros has seen Europe torn apart by war. He has lived through a time in Europe when there were millions of people displaced and on the move, and indeed killed by the Second World War. And one wonders if this, which must have been a very formative influence upon him as a young man before he came to study here in London, in fact, whether this is something that he feels opportunities given to refugees will help in the long term. I mean, obviously, he's himself a massive refugee success story, if you like, but and clearly, in a sense, he wants to give something back, but he also wants to reward enterprise where he sees it.
And it's interesting as well, Mary, in that, you know, when you look at refugees who make it to other countries, on the whole, these are the people who are the better educated and the better equipped to deal with their new lives, and just the sort of people that have the entrepreneurial spirit or the academic backgrounds to succeed.
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say, when I saw this report, I thought this was fantastic. It was a brilliant idea, and it was the sort of idea that almost only somebody like Soros could come up with and put such credibility behind. It was imaginative. It needed the scale of money that he had to do it. And, you know, I have quarrels with Soros because I don't completely take his view on, say, things Russian. I certainly absolutely deplore his intervention in the financial markets, which saw Britain ejected from the European exchange rate mechanism and really dashed all hopes that Britain would ever be in the euro. So, you know, I don't agree with Soros on a lot of things, but on this, I think this is really fantastic, and I think it would be a part of his legacy and a very, very good one.
Without wishing to get into the mechanics of the exchange rate mechanism in 1992, in a sense, he was just taking advantage of Britain's weaknesses rather than instigating it, wasn't he?
Well, this is true. Yeah. But if some of the money that he gambled and won with that particular move is now going into this project, then who can object?
There we are. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much to Mary and to James. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's music next, and there's more shows throughout the evening. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the night. Midori House, back same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.